If you think we're on the run.
Hello one and all, and welcome to episode 40 of the Dad's Army podcast. It's great to have you with us as usual. So podcast number 40 then, well that's quite a milestone really, isn't it? Well, to be honest with you, if you consider all of the special podcasts that we did without allocating an episode number, we're more like the 45th or 46th episode really. But officially, this is our 40th podcast, and as such, we have something a little bit special for you. Now, fairly recently, I got together with Nicholas Ridley. That's Arnold Ridley's son. Now, Nicholas, as many of you will already know, has written a book called Godfrey's Ghost, and that covers his father's career from Nicholas' perspective. And it's a fascinating read. Nicholas was good enough to forward me an advance copy a couple of months ago now, and I finished reading it, well, after I managed to get round to start reading it, I finished it inside 2 weeks. It was a really riveting read, and it's something that I thoroughly enjoyed and would recommend to absolutely everyone who's got an interest in Dad's Army. Nicholas and I got together to discuss the book, and we also, as you would expect, talked about Arnold's involvement, his life within Dad's Army, and of course Nicholas has done quite a bit of research into what other people have already written about his father, and I think he provides a truly unique perspective on what it's like to basically be related to one of the stars of the show that we all know and love. So that's coming up fairly soon.
You're listening to the Dad's Army podcast with your host James.
Just a couple of announcements before we get to that interview. Well, announcement sounds very formal, but basically things I want to say. First of all, I want to say thank you to two more listeners. That's David Keith and Patricia Gosling for donating a sum of money to keep the podcast going. That's exceptionally kind of you. And it's also very humbling, if I'm absolutely honest, to know that there are listeners out there prepared to put their hands in their pocket to keep the podcast going. So thank you very much indeed, David, and thank you, Patricia. If you'd like to make a donation in the same way, then all you need to do is go onto the podcast homepage and click the donate button. Just a quick word about the upcoming Frank Williams event. Now, at the time of recording, that event is less than a week away. It's happening on the 21st of November 2009. Now, Frank is going to be there. We're going to have a whole load of unique and extremely rare snippets of Frank's recent work. Not only things that he's acted in and starred in, but also we're going to be showing a couple of clips of things that he's written that have subsequently been adapted. So I'm really looking forward to the evening. I haven't seen all of the material yet. The showcase, as I'm sure many of you know, will be the full-length version of Dad's Army and Beyond, the Frank Williams story, which is a professional half-an-hour documentary all about Frank's life and career. Clearly, it's embedded in Dad's Army, but does go well beyond Frank's involvement in Dad's Army, as the title suggests. Now, you cannot pre-book anymore, I'm afraid, because we've gone past a particular deadline, and I've needed to already book the fish and chip suppers. And I'm very pleased to say that we've booked for over 75 of you who have pre-booked. So I look forward to meeting you all in Kentish Town next Saturday. However, if you haven't managed to make your booking and you wanted to attend, then you can turn up on the door. However, you need to be very aware that we will not be able to feed you. So you can come along and enjoy the evening, enjoy Frank's talking, he's always very riveting, and enjoy the screenings, but we won't be able to feed you, I'm afraid. So you need to have eaten beforehand or bring your sandwiches with you. As such, the ticket price on the door will be reduced to £6. So feel free to come along. If you want to have a look at the location and all the event details, head on over to the Dad's Army podcast blog. That's www.dadsarmypodcast.blogspot.com. I hope to see a lot more of you there in the evening. Feedback and news we haven't touched on the last couple of podcasts, and it is stacking up. I'm not going to go through it this podcast because the majority of it will be given over to my interview with Nicholas. So I hope you enjoy that instead. However, please keep the emails coming in. We've had absolutely loads of emails once again, and I'm looking forward to going through that feedback, which will probably be in the January or February podcast now of 2010. But please keep those emails coming. I might get to them beforehand. I might even be able to record a short feedback podcast where we just go through the feedback between now and Christmas. You never know. Anyway, enough to preliminary blather from me. I hope you enjoy the interview, and we'll be right back.
I'm Barry Scott.
Ooh, that was a bit noisy. Hello, this is a promo for the Flashing Blade podcast. I'm Tony, and this is my plucky girl assistant, Jo.
Hello.
That was a bit breathy Kensington Miss, wasn't it?
Hello.
Anyway, what do we do? What do we talk about?
Oh, we talk about stuff and things.
And things?
Yeah, in equal measures.
Stuff and things. Doctor Who, science fiction, all sorts of silly stuff like that, but mainly Doctor Who, because it's my obsession. I'm the ancient wise one, and Jo knows, well, bugger all really about it.
I'm the plucky one, apparently, allegedly.
Yes, she's very, very, very plucky. We get Jo's completely fresh views on all sorts of things to do with Doctor Who, and my ancient, ingrained, indefinable magic views. So that's the Flashing Blade podcast, available from www.flashingblade.org.uk, iTunes, Podcast, Ali, blah, 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 blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah.
That's the end of this promo. Toodles!
Bye!
And we're back with a Dad's Army podcast. Now, you may remember, in previous podcasts, we've spoken about a number of new publications that have come onto the Dad's Army scene. One of them is a new book that's been authored by Arnold Ridley's son, Nicholas. It's called Godfrey's Ghost, From Father to Son, and it's published by Morgzilla Life. It was published on the 1st of August 2009. And I'm very pleased to be able to say Nicholas joins me now. Welcome to the podcast, Nicholas.
Well, thanks very much. Lovely to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. I'd like to start by talking a little about the style in which you've written this book. Firstly, the clue, if you like, is in the title, From Father to Son. But the narrative is told from your perspective. It's you describing the events in your father's life, sometimes in real time, to your son. And therefore the reader sees things from your son's point of view. And that style of storytelling makes the book feel so much more accessible than a straightforward description of events. What made you decide to tell the story in that way?
Well, I suppose that's, to be honest, that's just the way it came out, if I'm honest. I wanted to tell the story of my father's life. I wanted to try and create a picture of him, to paint a portrait of him for my son, because I was, I think, a number of reasons, but I think I was slightly anxious that my son, and indeed my daughters as well, could always switch on the television or switch on a DVD, and they could see this rather sweet, bumbling old man, Private Godfrey, and that they might somehow confuse Godfrey the character with Arnold Ridley, their grandfather. They didn't know him because, in fact, he died 25 years ago when my son was under two, and my daughters were, my elder daughter had only just been born. And so I was very keen that they would actually get a picture of my father as he really was, because he was a remarkable man. He lived what in many ways was an extraordinary life. And that's really what I wanted to get across. And I suppose I'm a great believer in stories, in anecdotes, if you like. And I think telling stories is a very good way to get towards the truth of the matter. Whereas a factual account, a chronological account, starting at the beginning and going through to the end, it may give you a certain comfort that you're getting the whole story, but I think probably in some ways, you know, you miss out a great deal. And if you want to, you know, if you want to get a picture across, if you want to engage your listener or your reader, stories are a great way to do it. So that's why it's thematic more than chronological, and perhaps a little bit unusual in that way.
Yeah, I think it works very, very well. And I think it covers pretty much all of your father's views and opinions, his likes, his dislikes, the way he lived his life, and the reasons why he chose to live his life the way he did. How did it feel to research those kinds of things about your father and then put it into writing?
I suppose, funnily enough, I didn't do a huge amount of formal research for a great deal of the book. So a great deal of it was from memory. And my memory of my father, and my time with him as a child, and what he said to me, and listening to him, because my father had this wonderful, rather unusual approach to children, in that he never talked down to them, and certainly never talked down to me. He always talked to me man to man, and he made no concession, I don't think, to the fact that I was a child, and I was aware. At the time, I think that although I didn't understand everything he was telling me at the time, in due course, I would understand what he was saying. Mm. And I think one of the great experiences of writing this book and thinking about him again and hearing his voice so clearly 25 years after he died was having him come back to me and actually finding that now, here I am, at the age of 62, learning a little bit more about what he meant by some of the things he said to me when I was five. So that was very much the heart of the book. I also had the opportunity to learn a great deal about his early life from his unpublished autobiography, which was a great source for his childhood, for his stories about his own mother and father, who were very, very important to him, and some of the extraordinary things that happened to him long, long before I was born, because he was 51 when I was born. So, I think in the book, to some extent, the first two acts of his life had already taken place by the time I was born, or indeed by the time he married my mother. So we were, if you like, the third act of his life. So the autobiography was particularly vivid about his childhood and his very early years. It was less good, less strong about the later years, because I think, he wrote it after Dad's army. He was in his 80s, and I think very often with older people, the distant past is much clearer, a much stronger reality than the recent past. And I think as he was writing it, he could relive his childhood. I think his middle years were less vivid as far in his memory, and the later years they were pretty scant. There were, for example, only 3 pages about Dad's army. That wasn't a reflection of how important Dad's army was for him, because it was extremely important, and he was hugely grateful to be cast as Private Godfrey. He loved playing the part, but it was just not as interesting to him as a subject to write about as his past. But funnily enough, the real research, the more formal research that I had to do, was about Dad's army itself, because in fact, and I hope your listeners won't feel too badly about this, and I had to admit as much to an audience at the Dad's Army Museum in Thetford, until last year I'd only watched half a dozen episodes of Dad's Army. It just wasn't part of my life. And the reason for that was that it started in 1969, which was the year I graduated from university, and in 1968-69 was the time that I was beginning to. In fact, it started in 1968, it did. Didn't it? Which was exactly yes. The year I graduated. Mm-hmm. I was involved in my own life. I went abroad. I spent most of my 20s and early 30s living and working abroad. I wasn't really around very much. I mean, mm-hmm. I was around occasionally. I was around for This Is Your Life, and performance at that time was not, I think, very creditable, as you perhaps see in the book. Dad's Army wasn't actually didn't mean very much to me. I mean, I was very grateful to it because it meant that my parents, after years and years of financial anxiety, had a certain degree of security which they hadn't known before. But it didn't really touch me, I found it for a long time quite difficult to explain why. I'm still not entirely sure. I hope in the book I perhaps begin to answer some of the questions about why. But having started to research it, you know, having had the huge privilege of meeting and talking to David Croft, Jimmy Perry, Frank Williams, Bill Pertree, I mean, wonderful, wonderful people who were so warm and so so supportive of what I was trying to do. That was marvellous, and I felt a great sort of a great warmth from that, and I felt they actually helped bring back a part of my father's life that, funnily enough, I might easily have ignored or not known about. Because I think, you know, when you're, and I find this with my own children, you know, when you're in your 20s, you have to go out and live your own life, don't you? And to some extent, you park your parents. And you say, well, okay, thanks for childhood and you know, love you to pieces, that's absolutely wonderful, but now I'm on my own. You just stay where you are, don't change, don't do anything new. And even our children, I think, are slightly disconcerted when they find that we've done something that is a little different from what they expect, or we have new friends. You know? So I think that's what I did with my father, and indeed my mother. I sort of parked them a little bit, and this bit of their life, funnily enough, I didn't know about. So talking to Jimmy Perry and the rest was wonderful. I went to the British Library. I read everything that I could find about Dad's Army. Very interesting stories indeed. Very amusing stories. And of course, I started bought the DVDs and then started watching the episodes one by one, fairly systematically. And you know, found that I actually liked Dad's Army enormously and thought it was wonderful. And to some extent, you know, rather regret not having having watched it for many years. But you know, it that was the bit that I actually had to research. That was much more formal research. Mm. That's a very long answer to your question.
I think it's wonderful, and there's about three or four questions that I want to ask you coming out of that, I think. You talked about research and going to the British Library, looking at Dad's Army and so on, and people who follow the programme, people who listen to the podcast, would have built up an affection for the programme over a number of months, years, decades probably. And you've probably condensed a number of different stories, a number of different versions of the programme's history into a very short period of time.
Yes.
And not only that, you're going to have a unique perspective because you've got these authors who you've probably never met before.
That's right.
Talking about your father. How did that feel? And did their accounts of your father marry up with your memory and your experience of your father?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's quite a complex one, isn't it? Because, and one doesn't want to be too terribly theoretical about it, but there are lots of things happening with actors, aren't there? There is the actor and the part and the character and the man. There are sort of four things interacting. And my father was a very complex man. So my father was one person. My father as an actor was another person. My father playing the part of Godfrey was obviously another aspect of him. And then as the character of Godfrey develops and has a life of its own, that, if you like, is almost a fourth aspect. So I, in many ways, when my father it was being talked about in books or accounts as dear Arnold, the lovely actor who the lovely old sweet gentleman who plays Private Godfrey, who's very accommodating and very grateful. Yes, that was certainly part of my father, but it was only part of him. Sometimes there were accounts that really were very definitely my father as I knew him. So Jimmy Perry said that my father and John Lorry very occasionally would be found talking together and talking about the First World War, which was the thing that united them. Mm. And he said that they shared an anger about the First World War, and that was what united them. And I thought, yes, that's my father. There were lovely bits that Frank Williams was able to tell me about the times in Thetford. where at the end of the day's filming in Thetford, the whole cast and crew would be at dinner together and you know, eating and drinking reasonably enthusiastically into the evening and possibly into the night, you know. And my father was very much not a nighttime man and would retire early, whereas my dear mother, who was very much a nighttime person, would have loved to join the conversation, because she was, if anything, much more theatrical than my father. She would have loved to be there, but out of very proper loyalty, joined him. And there was, and Frank was able to sort of paint the picture of them at the dinner table. You know, my father saying, "Well, I'm off to bed now," and my mother with a certain reluctance going with him. And I could picture them. I could so much picture them. Or he's talking about them. My mother driving my father from location to location, putting up their deck chairs, you know, and unwinding the thermos flask of tea and eating some dreadful sandwich or other, you know. And I could just see them. I could see them together in a very companionable way, and I could see the tremendous support that she was for him, because, you know, physically it was quite a strain, I think, you know. I mean, yeah, obviously, you know, in your late 70s and early 80s, you know, it's quite physically stressful, I think, to, you know, to go out and on location. Mm-hmm. Although David Croft was absolutely brilliant the way that he handled, I think, his older actors. And because my father was always very grateful, I think he got a lot of special treatment, and you know, I think he was spared quite a bit of running around, for example. And there are many stories which I liked enormously of rehearsals where my father's scene might be rehearsed early, you know, early in the evening, so that he could go home early. Mm-hmm. And I could picture that, and I could picture with gratitude how David Croft had sort of handled the whole thing. My father had made it all happen because of his gratitude and because of his gentle attitude. But he wasn't, of course, you know, he wasn't this gentle man, you know. He certainly wasn't a feeble man, and he wasn't a weak man. He was a strong, strong man, strong morally, a strong character. And my father's wonderful agent, Bill McLean, said at one stage, you know, sweet and gentle. Sweet and gentle when things were going right.
I think pretty much everyone who's heard of your father will have Private Godfrey in mind when they hear the name Arnold Ridley. And fans of the show, and I include myself in this, have you know, a preconception of not only what, you know, the character is famous for, but a preconception of what the actor is like as well. And one thing your book really made very, very clear to me was that all of my preconceptions about Arnold were completely wrong. It was really refreshing to see that there was a different side sometimes. Was that a deliberate attempt when you were writing the book to give a little bit more as to how people see your father?
Well, I think so. I mean, he was, as I say, a truly remarkable man. And he'd lived an extraordinary life with lots and lots of ups and downs. And, I mean, apart from the wartime experiences and things like that, I mean, he experienced the extremes of poverty and wealth and fame and obscurity, real emotional upset, and then, you know, a high degree of family happiness. So he managed to cope with the extremities that life threw at him extraordinarily well, because he was a very strong man. And I must admit that I can't imagine that many people would have coped as well as he did. And I guess that the Dear Arnold bit, I think, was a survival mechanism. His way of approaching old age was to go gently wherever he could. Whereas John Laurie's approach was rather different. John Laurie, you know, rage against the dying of the light. Well, he was a rage man. Mm. And I don't think one way or the other way is the best way. I think you choose your own way. And here I am in my 60s and I'm looking for models, you know, of how to approach old age. You know, am I going to go gently or am I going to rage? I think my instinct is that I'm going to rage, actually. So the Dear Arnold thing was, while not false, because he was a gentle man and he was a very, very gentle father. To be honest, the idea of my father disciplining me in any fierce way is quite unthinkable, absolutely impossible. The worst thing that could happen to me as a child was my father's disappointment. If I detected any sense of disappointment, that was as bad as it could get. My mother did all the discipline, you know. So he was a gentleman. I mean, he'd seen enough violence in his life, I think. But he was a tough man. He was morally strong. And it may sound very sentimental to you to say this, but I cannot imagine my father doing anything that he felt was wrong. Now, my son might, in sentimental moments, say that about me, but it wouldn't be true. It wouldn't be true. With my father, it was true. I cannot imagine him doing anything mean, unkind, or anything that he thought was morally wrong. Mm. I'm not sure you could say that about many people.
No, not at all. I think that comes across very much in the book, not through you saying it as directly as you just have, but the way in which he dealt with situations that he found himself in, particularly when there were, you know, times were hard, and rather than rage or become very frustrated, it was a case of, well, how do I get out of this? What do I do now? You mentioned your father's experience in World War One when he was chatting to John Laurie about that on location. I knew a little bit about this. I think through previous contact we'd had, you'd sent me an email concerning your father's involvement in World War One.
Yes.
And that was the first really deep information that I'd had access to or had been made aware of concerning, you know, the kind of horrors that he faced. And both your description, your narrative in the book, and also parts of your father's autobiography make it very, very clear as to how awful that war was.
Yes, yes.
How do you think your father analysed the contradiction, if you like? He experienced the worst that life can throw at him, the worst that one human can do to another. He saw that very close up. And then he featured in a situation comedy with a wartime setting. You know, that must have been an extremely, almost ironic set of circumstances.
Yes. Well, I mean, there is obviously an irony in it. I think, to be honest, it wouldn't be anything that concerned him particularly at all. I mean, I think that, and this may sound very, very, very banal, but I think he, like most actors, sees a part as a part, you know, and here's a job to do, here's a part to play, here's a wonderful script, here are some marvellous scenes and some excellent lines. Let's get on and play it. And I think, to be honest, that the thoughts or memories of the war or his own wartime experiences, because, of course, he fought in the First World War and the Second World War, and, in fact, something which I don't think I have in the book, but is nonetheless true, is that he was actually a member of the Home Guard as well. So he, you know, I'm rather proud of the fact that he has three ticks in his boxes there. He joined the local Defence Volunteers, and, in fact, they actually saw something very close to active service, because the Battle of Britain was going on overhead. He tells the story of how he was strafed by a German fighter plane in Surrey, and how he came up to London and went to the Savage Club, his club in the West End, you know, covered in mud, and everybody said, you know, well, why are you covered in mud? And he said, well, I've just had to dive into a ditch. And nobody believed him, because, of course, the Battle of Britain hadn't hit London at that stage. Yeah. So, you know, having been evacuated from France, in 1940, which was horrific, and again, the details are very, very unclear quite what happened, it plainly appalled him, whatever it was that happened, and so much so that he didn't talk about that at all. He didn't talk much about the First World War, but he didn't talk about the Second World War at all. So you'd think, well, having had all that, that would be enough. Why then did he join the local defence volunteers? There are certain mysteries there, which some of which I might be able to uncover later on, but I think he was just a man who felt he had his duty to do and did it.
No, it seems intrinsically linked, really, with war, either actual war or performing at the end of his career, really, for 9 years in a wartime setting. There are a couple of stories in your book concerning active service that your father saw during the war, and I just wondered if you'd be able to tell us a little bit about where he ought to have been awarded the military medal, but didn't actually receive it in the end.
Yes. Oh dear, it's a very sad story. Well, the Battle of the Somme, he found himself, he was fortunate to survive, first of all, very, very fortunate indeed, because the poor Somerset Light Infantry, you know, was massacred that morning, absolutely massacred. But he managed to after 3 days, managed to sort of get himself out of the shell hole where he'd been sheltering, and gradually made his way towards the British lines, rounding up on the way a few other stragglers, and they managed to make it to the British lines, where an officer spotted them and said, "Well, you know, this is wonderful chaps, you know," and took their names and recommended them all for the military medal. Now, the military medal was the infantryman's medal of the First World War. More than 100,000 were awarded, but the officer, unfortunately, as it happened, spotted my father was a lance corporal, and therefore, in theory at least, was in charge of this small group of people. And so he was recommended for the DCM, which is a sort of higher order, a higher medal altogether. And as it happened, and very sadly, the other boys all got their military medals, and my father was turned down for the DCM. Mm. And I think it was a major disappointment to him. I think if it had been me, I would have felt bitter about it.
Yeah.
But my father was not a bitter man. Bitterness was not part of his makeup. And there is a terrible tragedy, a terrible irony, really, in that wonderful episode, Branded, you know, where at the end of which they go and see Godfrey in his striped pyjamas lying in bed, you know, and there's this photograph of Godfrey wearing the military medal, which was awarded as a non-combatant at the Somme. And so a lovely idea that there's this fictional non-combatant who's awarded the military medal, whereas my father then in 1982, I think, was awarded the OBE, for which he was extremely grateful, for playing a doddery old non-combatant, but got nothing for his wartime services in two wars. You know, but it didn't worry him, I don't think, at all. Worried me, still does a little bit.
I can understand why.
I'm still slightly angry about it. You know, I think he deserved his military medal. He really did.
I mean, I wondered when I first read that whether or not at some point somebody had had a word with Jimmy Perry and David Croft. I wonder whether that was just a huge coincidence.
I have no idea.
I'd love to know.
No idea. I mean, They were such clever writers. I think they did begin to learn a great deal about the men who were the actors who played the characters that they wrote. I think they knew a lot. I think they were very, very intuitive and insightful people. Maybe a story came out. I mean, my father quite enjoyed stories where he was the poor fish, in his words, where he came out against all the odds. Everything went against him a little bit. I mean, in fact, his whole enlistment in the Somerset Light Infantry was a story that he did quite enjoy telling. Not in a bitter way, but as if to express the strangeness of life, that he volunteered in August 1914 with, I think, six other blokes, and they went down on the first day to volunteer and to join the Somerset Light Infantry, and the six boys with him were all accepted, and my father was turned down because he had a badly broken toe, a toe he'd broken, I think, at playing rugby, and they were looking for physical perfection in August 1914. And these boys went out to replace regular army units in the Indian Army. And so they went to India. During the whole of the time they were there, they didn't hear a single shot fired in battle. Whereas my father's cohort, because he re-volunteered in 1915, well, most of them died. Yeah. Simple as that. Most of them were killed. Mm-hmm. The Somerset boy died. And if you go to the Somme, and I went for the first time last year with Richard Van Emden, the First World War historian, which was fascinating, and he showed me the spot where my father, where he received his final wounds, because he had three wounds at the Somme, actually to see what the Somersets were asked to do, to charge up a hill against German trenches which hadn't been properly reconnoitred, where there was another trench that they hadn't spotted. Mm. And it's always been a puzzle to me why I've not seen Somerset Light Infantry boys in the cemeteries in France, because they're just not there. But they're all on the war memorial because they were all lost in the mud and the dirt in that ridiculous assault. So there are about five or six with gravestones nearby, but that's it. The rest are just lost in battle.
I seem to remember, I think that was reported at the time, there was a couple of articles in the paper, I think, about you visiting that particular part of France. Given that you were an only child and Arnold was 51 when you were born, as you've already mentioned, did you feel very protective of him when he became a household name through Dad's Army?
I think I always felt slightly protective about my father. I think from a fairly early age I was conscious that he was an older father. And 51 was older as a father then than 51 as a father is now. It's not so uncommon to actually have children in your 50s. I have many friends who have children in their 50s. So I was conscious that he was physically quite frail. You know, when we played cricket together, for example, I would never hit the ball as hard as I could, because I didn't want him to have to run too far to collect it. So we didn't have the physical adventures that I have had with my son, but we had other things which were different and just as important, possibly in some cases, I might think more important. We had a lot of time together to talk. But anyway, I think I did feel protective of him. I didn't like the idea that I hated it on an occasion when a friend of his mistook me for his grandson. It really enraged me, and I can't quite describe or come to terms with the feelings of shame and anger that I felt as a 5 or 6 year old. You know, I wanted my father not to be mistaken as a grandfather. I wanted him not to be thought of as an old man, which to some extent he possibly was, because as I say, I think, you know, being in your 50s then is a lot older than being in your 60s now. When he was in Dad's Army, well, of course, by that time I was an adult rather than a child. I wasn't particularly happy when people would shout out at him, do you want to go? Do you want to be excused, Godfrey? Mm. You know, in the street, you know, it just seemed particularly vulgar, unnecessary. But, you know, they didn't mean any harm, and it's one of the things that as an actor, you know, you have to get used to. I mean, people do confuse you as a man with you as a part, and you just have to live with it. It comes, as they say, it comes with the territory. Sure. My father, I think, was remarkably good at actually coping with that most of the time, particularly as he was a reasonably shy man in some ways. And if he couldn't cope with it, then he had various strategies for avoiding it. So I think Frank Williams has a nice story that when they were on tour, and if my father was feeling that he just had enough of being Godfrey in the public eye, and he saw people coming towards them waving and smiling, he might disappear into a shop rather quickly to avoid them and leave the others to cope with the autograph hunters. But I think on the whole he was pretty good with the public. I In a way, I think I probably did feel fairly protective. It isn't really how, this is such a difficult thing to say, but I would prefer my father not to be remembered as Private Godfrey. I would prefer him to be remembered as Arnold Ridley. I'd prefer him to be remembered as a fine actor and a very good playwright. And of course, for me, he was just a wonderful father. That's who he was for me. Not an actor, not a writer, certainly not Godfrey. But I have no control over how he's remembered. And, you know, there are many worse ways to be remembered than being remembered as a rather gentle, bumbling old man. You know, it's not a bad way Absolutely. To be remembered, is it?
And I think it comes through very clearly in your narrative in the book as well. And I think it's probably something that's not just strange to actors, but anyone these days in particular, with the world of celebrity the way it is, has a certain image, and it's very, very unlikely, I think, to resemble how they are in real life. And that, strangely, as you mentioned, is probably not as hard for the individuals themselves as it is for their family, yes. because they haven't actually chosen, or might not necessarily have chosen, to go into a particular career that attracts that kind of attention.
Exactly right.
And, and I think the way you describe how you handled that in the book, I think is really interesting. And again, made me consider the whole concept of fame, if you like, yes. in a slightly different way.
Yes. I mean, fame is something I'm really interested in because there's so many young people seem to say, well, what is your ambition? Oh, I want to be famous. And I've only been on the periphery of very, very marginal periphery of fame. I don't want to be famous. I don't want to be recognised in the street. I've had some insight into what's involved.
Of course.
And I don't want it. And so when the little story, my daughter won't forgive me for telling you this, so I hope she doesn't hear this broadcast. But my younger daughter, Lottie, to wind me up a little bit, has always said, oh, I want to be famous, I want to be famous. You know, I said, don't be so silly. Anyway, well, that's not an ambition at all. Oh, no, Dad, oh, I want to be famous, I want to be famous. But I know she's kidding, but I can't quite accommodate it. Anyway, we went to the Dad's Army Day at Bressingham last May. And, I mean, it's great fun. And I went with my daughter Catherine and Lottie, my younger daughter. And there were lots of nice people there, and they wanted autographs, and they wanted to be photographed with us, and everybody was so nice, and it was so agreeable, and for me, it was quite like, it was quite like other experiences. It's like being at a conference or an exhibition, you know, it's perfectly okay, and you know, you smile, and you shake hands, and you're agreeable. It's not difficult. But Lottie, over the course of the day, began to find it more and more difficult, and I could see the stress beginning to actually tell. And so, on the way back in the car, she said, "Dad, I've changed my mind. I don't want to be famous anymore."
Oh, wow. Well, it's Bressingham is well respected and talked about for a number of reasons, but I think that's the first time I've heard it being used as a basis of a career choice. but good on it. I mean, Dad's Army is a phenomenal success. I mean, I think that's almost indisputable, irrespective of how people view the characters and the actors. But some people don't like Dad's Army. I mean, my wife, for instance, cannot understand my fascination with the programme, and she doesn't find it funny in the slightest. you've already mentioned that you've watched Dad's Army quite recently.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you actually think of the comedy? Does it make you smile?
I think it's brilliant, actually. I mean, I think the scripts are very, very strong indeed. I think they're wonderful scripts that actually make sense. They're quite formal in some ways. There are no loose ends. It all comes together. It's a masterclass in how to write good situation comedy. It's also actually a bit of a masterclass in the variety of comedy that's available to writers for television, because you can move from something that is like Branded, which is tragicomedy, which is real character comedy, very bittersweet. If you go back to the scenes where Godfrey is being ostracised, you know, it's a lump in the throat time.
Absolutely.
And it's, why is everybody being so beastly? Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing a darker side of some of these characters. And then it all comes right in the end. But it's really strong, beautifully written tragedy. There's some just good situation tragedy. There's some character tragedy. There's some just slapstick, funny business, which is difficult to write. It's not easy to write, and it's very, very difficult to perform. Mm. So it's a great variety. It moves almost from classical comedy to end-of-peer comedy.
Absolutely.
And it covers the whole range. And apart from the scripts, what you have is just a very, very strong cast, which I guess might be very difficult to put together today, because you have your wonderful three leads. Then behind them you have seven very, very strong actors. And behind them you have actors in the platoon, because they weren't extras, they were actors, and as far as possible they were kept throughout the whole series. Mm-hmm. So it's a real professional cast, and I think that's magic. Mm. And then I think also that the production values were very strong, in the sense that Jimmy and David, for them, the Second World War is still very much a reality, and they needed to get everything right. Now, to me and to you, post-war children, we probably wouldn't know whether some of these things were authentic or not. But that authenticity, I think, gives a backbone to the whole show. There is something real and true about it, and even if we don't know the detail of why it's true, that truth comes through, I think. And I think that's one of the strengths of it. My own theory, which you may think is complete nonsense, but seeing it now, of course, there are all sorts of fluffs and production mistakes and continuity errors and things like that. Things which today would be edited out, and for various reasons, I mean, partly I think the age of the cast, that maybe they couldn't do the scene two or three times. But I think by leaving these things in, by leaving the little mistakes in that we can all enjoy, the slightly fluffed lines or the matchbox that should stand up but then falls over by mistake, these little things which don't matter, I think it actually means that it feels live every time you watch it. Mm. Because it hasn't been polished and shaped to the high degree that we now come to expect. And so I think that sort of, I don't know, that immediacy is what actually still comes through.
Mm. No, I completely agree with you. And I think that a TV programme simply wouldn't be made in that way anymore. Partly, I think, from the ensemble setup, it would just be too expensive.
Exactly right.
The minute you get successful, actors who become personalities in their own right, especially in today's age, they command huge salaries. So that I think is a complete non-starter. But going back to what you were saying earlier on about the accuracy, particularly of wartime details. Now, we've spoken about this on the podcast before, because every time you check something out, it is absolutely precise. And I think, I don't know whether this is completely true, but I think particularly at the beginning of the series, when it came under a lot of criticism, because, all the making a mockery of the World War, all of the kind of things that they later didn't have to argue because people realised what they were about, they tried to portray the war in an absolutely accurate setting.
Yeah.
And I think that contrared and counteracted a lot of the accusations that they're not actually taking this seriously and they're turning the war into a farce. And I think they performed fantastic drama. Branded is a wonderful example of wartime events in a comedic background.
Yes,
but
yes.
It was essentially based within a tragedy, and that's what made it unique, I feel. And it's interesting, as I said, I'm very, very glad, really, that your father got such an episode that people remember. And again, Branded is another episode that they're going to be performing on stage next year.
Oh, is it?
It is. And that's going to be very interesting.
Oh, excellent, yes.
And I'll be very interested to see who they cast as Godfrey this time around.
Yes.
And they're doing some of the episodes that people considered to be really instrumental or stand out. So it's good to know that one of those featured your father prominently.
It'd be wonderful, yeah. And I think it'll make good stage theatre, actually. I think it's a very strong script. But I mean, I think the point about making a mockery of the war, I just, maybe it's just with hindsight, but it doesn't seem to be the case at all. I mean, I think the war is the serious backdrop, and I think it's only because it's taken seriously that the comedy works, and that there is this real threat there. And if one, you know, if you read what Jimmy Perry writes, or if you have the privilege of talking to him, you know, the war and the heroism of the war matter to him immensely today. There is nothing apologetic about his view of the war and about the role that he felt that the Home Guard played. I mean, it is very much it's a very serious role. So I think I think people might have been being oversensitive in 1968, but there were also some quite odd chaps at the BBC in those days.
I'm sure. I think perhaps it was just too recent a history for some people. BBC is, as you say, staffed by elderly gents who had very, very preconceived ideas about certain things, the war being one. And I know that they had difficulty in getting this programme off the ground, partially for that reason. But I think it's what you say is borne out in anything that Jimmy Perry talks about today. Because it wasn't just taken seriously in the first couple of series, it was taken seriously in series 9. And there was absolutely no denigration of the war at any point. So, anyway, I'm digressing and I'm losing track in my notes here as well. I will just put us back to the book if we can. Yeah. And as we draw in towards the close of our discussion, I think it's appropriate to focus on the last few chapters of your book as well. And I have to say, I approached this book, I hadn't met yourself, I clearly didn't know Arnold, I didn't know anybody here at all, and I became very conscious that the people I were reading about weren't just fictitious characters in a novel, for instance. And certainly when you described very traumatic points in anybody's life towards the end, I really was taken with how you wrote the events. It must have been extremely difficult to put those kind of feelings in writing.
In a sense, yes. I mean, I think it's difficult to get it right.
Yeah.
As you know, this is not a conventional showbiz biography. In fact, it's a very, very strange mixture of biography and autobiography, because it has my father's autobiography quoted quite extensively, and memoir. And it's really about, to a great extent, it's about families and relationships, more than obviously show business, although the theatre and the television, being my father's profession, obviously feature a great deal throughout. But I'm particularly interested in the relationship between fathers and sons, and I hope that that's come out. And what I wanted to do was to try and paint the story honestly. And you know, life has many, many joys, but it has many tragedies, it has many difficulties, and I didn't want to skip those. So this is certainly not misery literature, as they say. I hope it's on the side of life, but it's also about death as well, and it's about age, and some of the things that we have to come to terms with. So that makes it sound terribly serious. I hope it doesn't come across as quite as serious as that. Although there was a rather a nice review I read, that somebody saying, you know, this book should come with a health warning, because I was reading it in a coffee shop, and I find myself with tears coming down my cheeks. I thought, oh well, you know, good. That's a bit of a result, you know. No. And a couple of people have said that to me, but I mean, life is like that. Life is sometimes it's comic and sometimes it's tragic. And I suppose what I wanted to do in this book dedicated to my son was to give him a notion of the extremities of life and, you know, how we cope with these things.
I think you have, and I think you take the reader with you on that journey.
Thank you so much.
There are so many things that I could ask you about your father, and I could quite easily have a second part, I think, to this podcast, but time is skipping away. We haven't even touched on your father's writing career, which again is something that I'm personally very interested in. But I would like to say thank you very much indeed for spending the time talking to us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. It's really, really has. It's been a delight. Thank you very much.
No problem at all. Bear in mind, you can go out and get this book on Amazon. You can get it in all good bookshops, as I think the expression
absolutely,
goes.
Absolutely, yes.
However, you may be able to pick up a copy absolutely free. It's signed by Nicholas. So all you have to do is answer one particular question.
Right.
Which you look very, very prepared to ask, Nicholas.
Yes, in fact, I can't find it, but yes, I'm doing this from memory now. Now, in the episode, The Test, wasn't it? It was The Test, where they had the wonderful cricket match. And Godfrey, against all probability, hits the winning six, doesn't he? Now, the question is, who was his batting partner in that episode?
Well, there you go. That should be a very, very straightforward question for everyone out there listening to this. If you do know the answer, then you can email it in to james@dadsarmypodcast.com. If you can just put Godfrey's ghost in the subject line, that makes it a lot easier for me to find your email and pick it out. And we'll draw the winning entry in a couple of weeks' time. And remember, that will be a free copies of Godfrey's Ghost written by Nicholas, and it will be signed as well. So that all that's really left is for me to say thank you once again, Nicholas. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure for me.
So who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler?
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to that interview as much as I enjoyed recording it. Meeting Nicholas was fantastic. It was really, really interesting to hear some of the stories that I'd heard before, but told from a completely new perspective. And I don't think any of us have got any idea what it's like actually being related to someone who featured in the programme that we all know and love. And it was absolutely brilliant to speak to Nicholas about his experiences and also to hear about Arnold's experiences with a slightly different perspective, as I said. So thanks ever so much, Nicholas, for spending the time talking to us. Really very much appreciated. Now, the next podcast will be coverage of the Frank Williams event that I've been going on about for the last few podcasts. Hopefully that will be out in December time. I'm not quite sure at what point. It depends how much editing that I need to do. Then after that, we'll be looking at the middle of January for our next podcast. So make sure you're sending feedback, james@dadsarmypodcast.com. Can't wait to hear from you as always. And you can always follow me on Twitter, which is www.twitter.com/dadsarmypodcast. I think that's just about everything, really. Send in your competition entries so that you can win assigned copies of Godfrey's Ghost. You have to go back and listen to Nicholas's question once again if you didn't catch it first time, but you send the competition entry to that email address which I've just mentioned, james@dadsarmypodcast.com. Look forward to speaking to you all very soon. Bye for now.